FA programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Robert Thurman, and we're talking about the effects of the Dalai Lama as a multinational leader and model, and also just world peace and how we can have more of this and create a less despair and more ethical ethics, more ethics in the world. So you were talking about how His Holiness is trying to pull in all the religions of the world.
Yes, that's right. And that's one of his three main purposes in life, is better understanding between the world religions, because long before the end of the 20th century, when sociologists and political scientists and anthropologists were freaked out because they were all, like the Marxists, expecting religions to wither away, you know, with all the glory of secular reason. And meanwhile, they all came roaring back with fundamentalism on all sides, including Christianity and everything, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, even Buddhism in some places. And so therefore they became, when armed with, in pluralistic societies, when armed with weaponry and involved in politics, it became really dangerous. And before that, I don't want to convert you people to Buddhism. And every time he gives a talk here in some non-Buddhist country, he says, I'm talking to you about the beauties and the marvelous Buddhist psychology, Buddhist ethics, Buddhist meditational methodology, and so forth, transformation, cultivation of compassion, development of mindfulness, all these kind of things. But this is not in order to make you Buddhist. You do that as a mindful Christian, as a compassionate Muslim, as a, et cetera, and which you have already in your traditions, and you use, if you can learn something from our psychological and spiritual experience, good. And we need to learn stuff from you, particularly from Christians. He likes to learn a kind of activism where the nuns make hospitals and they do schools and, you know, they have like an outreach thing in society. That's his big thing, where Buddhists are a little too complacent and they're off there in their monastery, you know, because the societies didn't need them as much in the old days, but they do now. And he's asked the Archbishop of Canterbury and different popes and different Muslim leaders in India, at least, and Hindu leaders, please try to minimize this thing of, we're going to convert you all to our thing, because it leads to, it's a form of projected egotism into religious institutions. You know, religions are basically service industries. They are not ownership industries. They don't own their believers. They serve them. Mm-hmm. And when they think they own them, then they want to have more of them, so they have a bigger ownership sphere. And that's not their purpose. That's not Jesus's purpose. His purpose was to free people, not to dominate and enslave them. And so all of the great religious teachers were like that. And so therefore, the Dalai Lama used to say, when he would gather religious teachers, you know, secular humanism is a religion. You know, scientism is, and materialism even, with their materialism, it's a religion. It's a big belief system, and maybe 1 billion people follow it. Even they may nominally go to a church or a synagogue or a mosque. They really don't believe in the future life particularly. They don't believe in God particularly, really. They don't live as they do. They maybe mouth some words, but they don't. So we have to deal with them as a worldview.
That's a huge part of the population.
Of course. He says around 1 billion. If you have 1.5 billion Muslims, 1.5 billion Christians, actually, if the communists would lay off it, you'd have probably around the same number of Buddhists. And then you have 1.5 billion secularists. And then the smaller religions, and Hinduism is almost 1 billion. And then there are smaller ones which are national and which are good. Judaism doesn't try to convert a lot of people. It tries to keep its own people. That's all. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. You have to be born one, more or less, unless you marry somebody and convert. But they don't go out proselytizing, which mm-hmm. is what's nice about them. Even Hindus, really, in the old days, you had to be born in a Hindu. And that's good from Dalai Lama's point of view, in the sense that you therefore live and let live about the other people, or you should. But, of course, everyone can turn what they have into a fundamentalism if they become absolutist and fanatic about it.
So what does this have to do with ethics?
So, well, you see, he felt that ethics based on science would have more impact for secular people. So he was saying, it's not good enough that we're going around saying God said do this or Buddha said do that. People have to see that human being gentle— human being being loving, human being being not do unto others as you have them would do unto you, and don't do what you wouldn't have them do unto you sort of thing, grows out of science about the nature of human beings. The baby has to be cuddled, you know, everybody has to be stroked and cuddled or their brain doesn't develop, you know. And these are scientific things. And also anger and violence and hatred is bad for your health. It releases cortisol in your system. You'll have a heart attack. You'll have circulatory problems. You know, being kind is, and he hasn't pushed it to the degree where women are better than men in this regard because they have oxytocin when they get stressed out instead of cortisol and violence. They tend to, not that they can be violent, but they tend that way, and therefore they're ahead but on the enlightenment and compassion sector, we have to admit, we guys.
So you're talking about physiologically.
That's
there
right.
Is a hormonal and difference.
Yes, and this is why, you know, I believe it took to me time because I knew him personally. It's hard to see about someone you know personally. But I believe if Shakyamuni Buddha were alive today, he would be the Dalai Lama. That's how he would serve the people and the world today. You know, not making them Buddhists and so on, but just helping them to gain more control over their emotions and their minds. That's what he would do. And actually, Shakyamuni Buddha in his own day created a secular ethics, in fact. Karma is not fate. Karma is not some mysterious providence or hand. Karma is causality of ethical behavior, including unethical thought, where you feel hostile, whether you don't express it, but you've feel angry and hostile at your enemy, or greed, where you feel lust for your think something you want to possess, or you're confused and depressed. These mental things can also be unethical or ethical as far as Buddhists goes. Speech, of course, we know can, and physical action we know can. And before Buddha's time, they thought that the gods controlled things, what happened to you, and karma meant a ritual action in a ceremony getting the gods to help you, you know. But Buddha then changed that and he said, no, karma, the action that determines your fate, is ethical action or unethical action. If you act unethically, you're going to get a bad result. If you act ethically, you're going to get a good result. So it was based on Buddha's science of the human nature, what human nature and what life is about. And the human being has evolved from lions and tigers and monkeys and things like that, just like Darwin. He was perfectly aware of that. And human beings have evolved to being a more gentle bunch of people. And our power comes from our sociality, our cooperativeness, the fact we're mammals, you know, we have the better half of our species. It gives birth, life, to beings inside their own bodies, which is doesn't just drop an egg in the sand and run off the ocean. You know,
yeah,
that's a big that's a big altruistic thing.
Right.
To have this total stranger come and have a condo in your belly for a year and wear you out and make you tired and, you know, make you eat things you didn't like before.
I want to ask for your advice. There's a word that is used in Buddhism that I think is just a wonderful word, and it's very helpful in, let's say, in these days and times, as we can we get riled up about certain actions that are happening right now in the world, and to develop love is to tap into a kind of generosity.
Yeah.
What is your advice for developing that generosity of spirit?
Yes, well, give gifts. As Mother Teresa said, you know, give until it hurts, she said, when she wouldn't go to the Nobel Peace Prize banquet, but gave all those guys entails and all those royalties, cheese sandwiches, you know, and said, take the money and give it to the poor and the starving. She did that. So she was trying to show that giving is very key, especially what you value, you know. You know, it's easy to give something you don't necessarily value, but giving something that you value is a great thing. And therefore, the first of the bodhisattva, you know, the would-be Buddha, the bodhisattva practices is dana, which means giving, you know, and generosity. And it doesn't necessarily mean, of course, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to give everything away and become poor. No, actually, generosity makes you want to gain wealth to give it, to make others wealthy. And actually, that is the power of commerce, actually. Buddha empowered merchants in his life. He was not against them. He was himself of a military class, and he disempowered them. He was a traitor, good old solid traitor to his class, in the sense that military, you know, there's a certain spark and spunk about soldiers marching around. It's kind of nice. But basically, it's oriented around a non-human thing, violence, you know, which humans are not well equipped for naturally. Do you know what I mean? We don't have armor-plated skin like a crocodile or a rhinoceros. We don't have a big horn growing out of our nose. We don't have fangs. We don't spit poison. But unfortunately, we can invent all that, and we can make machines that do that better than the animals. But basically, we are gentle, soft-skinned, you know, mm-hmm. and we break our fingernail if we try to claw somebody like a tiger, you know.
So developing generosity.
Yeah, so, but the point is letting go, you know, is generosity. And last night, Matthew was talking about Meister Eckhart and the concept of Gelassenheit, you know, letting go-ness, German for letting go-ness. And that's related to generosity. You know, Buddha's previous life, just before becoming a Buddha, was a prince called Vesantara, which means one who's nearby the merchants, actually, his name. And, that's right. Buddha liked the merchants because merchants thrive by helping the customer thrive. You know, commerce is based on a kind of altruism. Yes, you try to make a good deal, but you want the guy you deal with to also get something out of it, so then you can go back and deal with them the next time around. You know, so they'll be good customers. They'll have a sense of loyalty. You bond with them through trade. The problem with the military is, of course, you get the best deal. You go and get everything they had. But you don't have commerce next year because you killed your customer.
So it cuts off the energy. It cuts off that flow between people.
So Buddhism grew with commerce and wealth in India, which was the wealthiest of all the Eurasian civilizations in that era. This is why Buddha was there and was tolerated there. And when they would have fried somebody who wanted to organize a bunch of free lunch needing monks and nuns in the middle of their society, in either China or West Asia or Europe, they would have gotten rid of such a person. But India had such a wealth and a surplus that they tolerated that. And he was of royal clan, so they respected him in a certain way. He was able to found that. And also, he didn't attack the religion. He broke away from it. But he didn't attack it, and he told his monks and nuns, don't act like priests, don't do birth ceremonies, don't do naming ceremonies, don't do marriages, don't do funerals, just become enlightened and get your one free lunch. Don't ask for dinner, don't ask for breakfast, just lunch. And then people will be cool with you, and then you can develop your spirit and your inner mind, men and women, and people from all classes, all castes. It was a marvelous thing that he did. Arnold Toynbee, without at all being a Buddhist, recognizes Buddha as the most efficient and most effective and most successful of the Axial Age teachers in mid-first millennium before the Common Era. He was in a culture that was more wealthy, so they were able to tolerate it. Like ancient India in Buddha's time was the California of Eurasia in that day, and people were more sensible, therefore.
I love it that you say more efficient and effective. It reminds me of Bucky Fuller would always go for that, which is more efficient and effective.
Oh, I love Bucky Fuller.
We all do. It's so wonderful.
Well, the sad thing is that, you know, younger generation nowadays doesn't even know who he is.
They have to tune into New Dimensions. We have hours with Bucky.
Oh, great.
You gotta download our programs with Bucky. I'm here with Robert Thurman. He's the co-creator of Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet, and with many other books and teachings and podcasts. You can go to his website, go to bobthurman.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Oh,
I'm here with Dr. Robert Thurman, and he's a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at the Department of Religion at Columbia University and president of the Tibet House U.S., which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation and promotion of Tibetan civilization, and also the co-creator of the newest book called Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet, which I highly recommend. And you were saying something, Bob, about activities without attachment. And it reminds me, it reminds me of something that changed my life. And this was back in the 70s. And you were there, I was there, and we were both there in Costa Rica when His Holiness the Dalai Lama was welcomed to Costa Rica by a head of state. And that was the first time that happened. Usually he would have to sneak into the back door because of the Chinese. But this time Oscar Arias welcomed him as a head of one head of state to another. And there was some moment in that conference when someone said, they asked him the question, I don't understand why you go around happy all the time. There's genocide happening to your people. You'll probably never get back to Tibet, and I don't understand. And His Holiness said something that changed my life. And he said, first of all, number one, you feel better when you're happier. It's just a practical matter. But secondly, he said, I do not know the future. I don't know how all of this is going to turn out. But every day I get up and I do what is right and good for me to do, not because I understand the outcome, but because it is right and good for me to do.
Oh, good.
And that just really got to me because I realized, Bob, that I was putting my eggs in the basket of only those things that I thought would succeed rather than following my heart in what I felt was the right and good thing to do for me.
Right.
Not because I would understand an outcome. But so this like helps us to not despair, because each day we get up and we're doing, maybe you're more articulate than I am.
Articulate. Please, you just said it.
Can you elaborate on what
sure.
I'm trying to convey?
First, could I do a sidebar?
Please.
You mentioned I was creator of Tibet House U.S. Let me just say my wife, Nena, is the creator of Tibet House U.S. I just give talks. I could never organize. I could never hold things together like that. She's totally the creator of Tibet House U.S. I just wanted to say that. And secondly, His Holiness especially gave us permission to announce officially we are the cultural center in America of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He's our patron and founder. We are all just co-founders. So I just wanted to make a sidebar about Tibet House. It's the first thing. That my wife created it, basically, and I and Philip Glass, lots of people helped, and they're still helping. And it isn't fully created. It has to become like a permanent monument to the survival of the Tibetan culture and the Tibetan people that will not go away no matter what happens.
And you've added some retreat property to that, too, the Menla.
Yes, someone gave us a place which we call Menla, and you can find it at menla.org, in order to show Tibetan medicine's wonderful body-mind, psychosomatic way of approaching illnesses and so on, using mindfulness and other deeper meditations and also herbal meditation and natural medicine and natural dietary things and so forth, like, Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine and Western herbal medicine, more natural, sort of naturopathic things. And gives a beautiful spiritual umbrella, the medicine Buddha does. And that's part of preserving Tibetan culture. So we were given a place, lock, stock, and barrel, by a wonderful lady, another Tara, like you, and another Tara, savioress, female, great spiritual being. And we're working on all that. So I just wanted to do as a little sidebar. I'm sorry to do that.
No, thank you so much.
I think I would like people to know that. And Tibet House also is the publisher of the Man of Peace book. And therefore, when people buy that book, they are also helping preserve Tibetan culture. And so that's another positive thing about it, and we're very happy about that. We managed, someone gave us a grant to, for the, it was the artists, the five artists who worked on it. And I'd also like to say about the book itself, there was a gentleman, my co-author, William Myers, who I put first in honor of him and his wife, because he brought the project to me at a certain inchoate phase. And then I jumped in, and then I brought another younger person. Three of us finished it. And lovely people supported it finally. And five artists worked very hard for 2 years, over 2 years. And what happened was the wife was dying of cancer and had been given 3 months to live. And then she met the Dalai Lama, luckily for her, and he somehow felt, I guess, his psychic intuition, whatever it is, that he could help her a little bit. He didn't promise her to cure it. He just said, if you would be interested in consulting my physicians in Dharamsala, maybe you could live a bit longer, he sort of said to her, you know, and more comfortably. And she did that, and she lived over 3 years. Mm-hmm. And during that time, she, out of gratitude, and because she was feeling well, although she knew she hadn't been able to, whatever kind of cancer it was, she felt out of gratitude, she would like to make a graphic novel that younger people as well as older people could read, so that His Holiness's message and mission and nature and everything could be well known by people in the future. So she started a little bit to putter away at it. And then when she did pass away, she bound her husband on deathbed wish, you know, please finish that. And so he was not a writer. He's a book designer and an environmentalist and a marvelous person, but he wasn't actually a writer at that point. He did write magazine things, especially on environment. So he puttered away for years, and then finally he brought it to Tibet House, and then it became a natural thing for us to join up forces, you know, maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then we had 2 years, last 2 years we got a grant and managed to finish it. So I have to honor her, you know, his wife, who really started us down that direction. And of course, I welcomed it because I'm always sad. People who love, even people who love His Holiness, they then say, because they're also, we're all brainwashed into despair, you understand. The reason we have a silly government now in the U.S., if not, and even silly to the degree of silly malevolence, government that is really inimical to the people that it's governing, which is what we have right now. And the reason we have that is because for decades now, the media has been conspiring and leadership has been conspiring to keep everyone really depressed by saying and keep everybody feeling that they can't do anything, so their vote won't matter. And they actually like the people who are super left and who act like, well, it's all evil anyway, and it's all terrible, and it's all should fall apart. People don't know that, but, you know, Hitler got in Germany because the socialists wouldn't vote in the 1932 election, thinking stupidly, it's all so bad, let it all go bad, and then we'll all win later, you know, ha, 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 you know. And everyone knows what happened after that. And so the American people are like that, and only less than 60% of them vote. If 80% even voted, of course, 100% should vote, who are eligible to vote. They could then suppress a lot of people like the Republicans do and cheat and things. But that's such a huge margin. It would be like Obama. They would win anyway in spite of the cheating because the margin would be big enough. The problem with Hillary was she didn't include the Bernie people properly, and therefore the margin was not big enough, and they cheated her out of the swing states. But she actually won everything. She, not just California, she won everything.
I don't want to get into the details because...
But it's important. Because people should realize they must be active. They are powerful. They don't have to be angry and just throw rocks in the street. They have to vote. They have to go out and run for sheriff. They have to run for, if they don't like Sheriff Arpaio, they should run for sheriff themselves. They have to go and run for school board. They have to be active and not just sit on the TV and swallow despair.
And
that there's nothing
that,
they can do.
Part of that is getting together in whatever small groups. I mean, I know
yes,
I have I have a group. In fact, we all went to a concert in the park yesterday, a Peace and
Wonderful.
Justice concert in the park, free concert. And
fabulous.
So we all kind of got together and danced together, and it was wonderful.
Great.
You
wonderful.
Know, and I belong to Joyful Noise Gospel Choir, and mm-hmm. we sing together. So
wonderful.
We have to have these things that gladden our hearts,
yes.
that keep us keep us energized for that kind of activism that you're talking
Resistance
about.
Resistance and activism should be joyous. I totally agree. For example, imagine if when some corrupt governor and secretary of state in some state puts one voting machine for 80,000 people in a poor neighborhood on purpose, and there's this line that is a mile long. If they were singing in the mile and the people were bringing them food and potluck and et cetera, then they would just wait it out.
And it would be a party.
That's right. And they'd be happy. They wouldn't
be
standing there.
Let's have a party in our voting lines.
Yeah, but the key thing is they'd make sure that they go and vote because they would not accept despair and depression and that nothing we do will help because it's true. You know, even seeing imperfections in their own person. It's a syllogism people should learn who are think of themselves as radical and wanting to really do the right thing. Lesser of evil equals less evil. How about that as a syllogism? That's unassailable, actually.
Right.
You know, lesser of evil doesn't mean everybody's evil. It just means less evil. And we need that always. And less evil is going toward goodness.
And not to be despaired if there's something that doesn't work out the way we want.
Exactly.
Let it go. We could go on and on. I love being with you, but I want to remind our listeners that I've been here with Robert Thurman, and he is the co-creator of his new book, Man of Peace, the Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, bobthurman.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3622.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Issa Gucciardi, author of Coming to Peace, and next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about my new book, Coming to Peace, Resolving Conflict Within Ourselves and with Others.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.